Skull, everybody. This is Alexander Ludwig, and you are listening to The Wild Hunt.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Wild Hunt, the No Ship Network podcast on the History Channel series Vikings. I am your host, Steve.
And I am your host, Em.
If you want to check out all the other stuff that we do, and we do a lot of stuff, I just put a doo-doo reference in there, go to our website at www.noship.net and check out everything else that we do, a bunch of other podcasts on a bunch of other really cool television shows, and it also will show you all of the ways that you can support us financially or otherwise. But the best thing that you can do right now is to go to iTunes and leave us a review.
Yes, and thanks for those who have left us reviews so far.
The other cool thing you can do is go check out the TV Time app, which we're all on, and you can communicate with us through there. And it's a really cool app that lets you know when your favorite television shows are coming on and keep track of them. It's pretty neat. You have to check it out to see what I'm saying, because there's a lot to it.
It's really helpful in these days where we have so many different avenues of watching the shows that we are into, you know, with all the various apps like Netflix, Hulu, and or cable. So not only can you go and see what the dates are going forward with the show you're watching, it'll actually give you notifications an hour prior to let you know that your show is about to air.
Which is actually kind of nice. It's a really good feature of that app, because my phone will go off and it has a special sound for it, which I'm sure that's not a, you know, news to anybody, but I'm not real big into apps or anything like that. So I don't use a whole lot of them, but I do use this app. So it lets me know when the television shows are coming on, and it's really useful and convenient.
All right. Is there anything else you want to say before we go into recap?
Nope. It's cold outside. I've got a beer, and we're ready to talk about an awesome episode of Vikings.
Yes, we are discussing Vikings Season 5, Episode 4, The Plan, written by Michael Hurst, directed by Steve St. Lager, which he directed the previous episode. I feel like this is the best episode I've seen in a long time. It was very thought-provoking, which made writing this recap really enjoyable for me.
Yeah, there's 0% filler in this. Everything was, it was just, every scene seemed to push the story forward in a meaningful way. There wasn't any kind of like do-do-do-do kind of stuff. So
yeah, no do-do-doots.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's a bad thing. You know, too much do-do-do will bring an episode down a little bit.
So as we've been doing this season, we are breaking up the recap by character. So we are going to start with Bjorn on this episode. And we first see Bjorn as the episode opens. Bjorn and company pass through the Pillars of Hercules into the Mediterranean Sea. Bjorn says, arguably with suspicion, how lucky they are to have run into Cynric. Cynric urges caution. Bjorn wants to go to Rome because he's, you know, has his map that has guided him to the Mediterranean in the first place. But because this map is old, Cynric counsels against going to Rome because it's no longer the central seat of power. He suggests instead, which was a surprise to me, that they should go to Sicily.
Yeah, I was surprised too. I didn't know exactly what he was going to say. I think I thought maybe Greece. So when you say suspicion that it's, you know, fortuitous that Bjorn ran into Cynric, do you think that they maybe forced him to come?
No, I think it's more of the other side. Like, Cynric probably manipulated his way onto the ship for his own.
Oh, okay. All right.
For his own benefit. So I think there's something, you know, more to Cynric's story that we're going to discover. And he's using the Viking some way. And he's probably, and I think Bjorn, though sometimes seems like a dummy, isn't always. And he's cottoning onto that.
Yeah, because of the scene later on that we'll get to. So yeah. He's not as dense as some might think that he is. There's times where he's definitely been dense, but I don't generally think of him as a stupid character. Mm-mm. So,
like I said, I was surprised about Sicily, mostly because I don't really know a lot about this particular time in history. I know the Byzantine Empire is responsible for keeping a lot of the literature we had and the knowledge we had at the time, so we have a lot to thank them for. I thought maybe Greece, but I thought more maybe like Turkey or something like that. So I didn't realize Sicily had some role to play in this particular history. So upon investigation, I learned a couple of things, and I'm sure I'll learn more going forward because I didn't have a whole lot of time to do too much investigation. But more on that when we get to Sicily.
Yeah, I was surprised too, but I don't know a whole lot about this era of history, you know, the decline of the Holy Roman Empire going into, I guess, what we look as look at as the Dark Ages or the medieval times,
right?
Kind of like into that going, because you know when you're in history and you take it in like grade school and even high school, it kind of gives you this impression that it's blocked off in these nice neat segments, and it's like you had the Roman Empire, then it got sacked by the Vandals, and then you had the Dark Ages. Then you had the Renaissance, then you had, you know, the Industrial Revolution and the modern period. And it's just like, it all just kind of goes along in these nice, neat little segments. And it's not like that at all. Obviously, there's declines and risings and ups and downs. But this particular period where the Holy Roman Empire is on the decline, I don't know a whole lot about either. It's like my knowledge in history kind of, there's a little bit of Roman stuff and then it skips up to World War II.
Yeah, it seems to me like it split between West and East and then became more powerful as the West declined and then the East became the Byzantine Empire. But that's what I remember from history class. The next time we see Bjorn, they are approaching Sicily in the dark. He asks Cynric to tell them about the island. Cynric reports that the current ruler of Sicily is a Byzantine commander called Euphemius. Euphemius, a very ambitious man, attempted to overthrow the Holy Roman Emperor. Bjorn wants to know, what is Byzantine, as he says, and who is the Holy Roman Emperor? We know that the show runs a little bit loosey-goosey with timelines, but this should be around like 826, 827 time frame.
Okay.
Anyway, so Cynric answers with the name Michael II, but not to worry. His rule could be over in a few months' time, which his rule will be over in 829.
So he wasn't very far off.
Cynric says, all things change. This world is impermanent and deceiving. Many things are not what they seem.
And the camera pans straight to Halfdan as he's saying that, or directly after he says that.
What do you make of that?
I don't know if it's just Hearst playing with us and trying to sow the seeds of, or just not sow the seeds, those have already been sown, but to try to water and tend those seeds of doubt as far as Halfdan being a straight up companion of Bjorn, just because they're both Vikings, you know? I'm wondering if there's going to be some sort of, you know, because in the earlier episodes of this season, he told his brother, he's like, I don't have to be right beside you to watch your back and to look out for our interests. So who knows?
I didn't even catch that. I was thinking more along the lines that this idea of fetters and deceiving oneself with delusions comes up because the seer says something. And again, the woman, the priestess who married Halfdan and Astrid also said something about the fetters, the invisible fetters of marriage binding.
You're probably Astrid. Right.
So, I mean, but it could work on two different levels. It can be part of an overarching theme, but then it can also be specifically talking about falseness and people, as you're describing.
Well, I know that Cynric is a little bit wary of Halfdan. You could tell by the way that he looks at him, the way that he talks to him, and his fears, or not fears, but his suspicions about him borne a little bit of fruit because, you know, when he puts a knife to him
later on
in the episode. So
Halfdan does telegraph, I will kill you, pretty heavily.
Is it the tattoos on the face or
I don't know. I think it's the evident murderous look on his face. So this scene ends with Bjorn saying, if they live, they will have many stories to tell in the Great Hall, if they live. Next, we see Bjorn and his men brought through Euphemius' gates on horseback. Cynric makes introductions. Euphemius doubts the claim that they are traitors. Bjorn hilariously says, of course we're traitors. Look how few boats we have brought. Why Cynric did not opt to translate something else is questionable. Maybe he feared someone else may know the Norse language and call him out. And we do learn that there has been Rus Vikings in the area.
Right.
At least around Michael II. Euphemius attacks Bjorn to prove that he knows that Bjorn is indeed not a traitor. All is well. They're welcome. They go inside. That evening, they feast. Cynric translates, Euphemius wants Bjorn and company to be his bodyguards, like Michael II has done with the Rus Vikings. Cynric says it is better that they agree, so Bjorn does. We are then introduced to a woman by the name of Cassia, a Christian nun. She captures the Norsemen's interests, particularly Halfdan's. Euphemius has stolen her from the Byzantium Empire.
So after they agree to become bodyguards, which I think they did pretty offhandedly, because I guess they're figuring, you know, well, if at some point we don't want to do the gig anymore, we're out. We get on our ships and go. Who's going to stop us? Because we're the bodyguards, you know. But when Euphemius gets up and he gives him a kiss, you know, Bjorn's just not used to that Greek style of love, if you know what I'm saying. He's just like, Halfdan's looking at him like, what the hell's going on over here? But the woman, Cassia, who is singing the song, I thought that was a really good casting choice because I think in the hands of a lesser director, it could have been this really young, slim little supermodel looking person to where the sexual interest would be just telegraphed to you a little bit too obviously, mm-hmm. you know? And I like the fact that, I mean, she's not in her 80s, but, you know, she's an older woman. She's not, you know, or at least she looks that way. I don't know who this person is, this actress is, or what her age is. I was just approving of the fact that we're using actresses of different ages. It's nice.
You know, you want to have somebody who's believable as a nun.
That's true, too. Yeah. Yeah. But the thing is, that's what I meant. That's what I kind of meant by saying in the hands of a lesser director, because lesser directors kind of go, I don't care about that. I'm getting the sex factor in here.
Yeah, that's true. So, you know, I think she's very beautiful. Again, I think she seems like very sophisticated and
I agree.
Distinctive. So I did look up Euphemius, and he there's, I guess, various accounts as far as what happened when he did kidnap a nun of a different name. He's reportedly had married her in one account. So that hasn't been said in this episode as of yet. And maybe it hasn't happened yet. But also when I was reading about Michael II, he was also married to a nun. I don't know if this is supposed to be the same nun, at least as far as like what the show is depicting to us, because a lot of times they'll blend historical characters into one. I guess we shall see, but nuns got around back in those days.
Yeah, apparently this is before they had to take their vows of celibacy as well. So, because we were talking about how bishops in that time didn't have to do that. And so I guess maybe nuns didn't either, or who knows. But hey, you know, when you're a nun and you get kidnapped, all bets are off, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so. So next scene in Sicily, Halfdan watches with fervid curiosity as Cassie approaches Cynric and a mysterious man in black. Cynric's involvement sparks investigation from Bjorn. He intercepts Cynric and tells him they saw him. Cynric says things are not as they seem, and he tells Bjorn about Ziadat Allah, who is probably the most important ruler in the Mediterranean, making Euphemius a client ruler. Halfdan asks Cynric who the man in black was.
And see, so Bjorn has a really good sense of what's going on. I mean, he came up with the term client ruler. He didn't have it. He wasn't parroting that from Cynric. So,
right.
You know, he has inherited some of his dad's intellect mm-hmm. and appraisal of situations and stuff like that. I was happy to see that, to where he was catching on. It wasn't like he was following two steps behind Cynric as he's trying to explain this to somebody.
Well, I mean, this is where he asks Cynric if he's conspiring against them. So, yeah, he's not a dummy. And Bjorn now wants to meet the Ziadat Allah because he's not really interested in these low-level
Let's
leaders.
Get past the flunkies. Let's get to the top of the food chain.
Things aren't as they seem. I'm thinking that actually Cassia is the one with the most power, maybe even more than Ziadat Allah.
And did you notice that this whole time, Halfdan is carving a rune into the stone?
Yes.
And I looked it up, and it's the Nordic rune for stalker. He's so obsessed with Cassie, it just came to mind. Like, you know, here he is.
Because I was trying to look up, was there any runes that had been found in Sicily? And that's why they made such a point to show us that. And I, you know, my quick search did not uncover anything. So if anybody has found anything like that, please write into noshipnetwork@gmail.com and let us know.
That like, jokes aside, I was wondering that too, like if they had him do that, because that's an actual historical thing. Like there was Nordic runes found in Sicily, and people are just scratching their heads going, how the hell did this happen?
And you have any thoughts on whether, Cassia has a lot of leverage, which we'll see in this next scene that I'm about to describe. So
Cassia definitely has some leverage, and I'm wondering, if we're going to discuss it now, I'm wondering if it's linked to Euphemius's attraction to her. Or if it's something else. But I don't know what the other thing would be, what the other leverage that she has, mm-hmm. because, I mean, she was kidnapped at some point. So she's kind of there, at least in a captive situation ostensibly, but she threatened to leave.
Yeah. So, the first time I watched it, well, I'm like, well, if she's a captive, does she mean suicide? I'm wondering if she's there, like you're saying, ostensibly, if it's there to appear that she's been kidnapped. Which will, you know, support what Cynric's saying, that things aren't as they seem.
The power behind the power.
So we'll get to that here now. Later, Bjorn, Halfdan, and Cynric encounter Euphemius, where Cynric sets upon him with Bjorn's request to meet Ziadat Allah. At first, Euphemius is unwilling until Cassia applies some leverage by threatening to leave. Last scene is Bjorn and his company on their boats as they set out to meet Ziadat Allah. Halfdan, still drawn to Cassia, wonders who she is. Bjorn suggests she could be the All Woman. Halfdan thinks she could be a pain in the neck.
Halfdan reminds me of nothing so much as a fourth grade kid on the schoolyard who runs up and punches the girl that he really likes in the arm to show her that he likes her, even though he doesn't realize that's actually what he's doing. You know, It's because Bjorn's just kind of like, yeah, you obviously fancy this woman. So what do you think? And it's like, oh, I don't like her. She's stupid. She's a pain in the neck. You know, it's like, come on. I just don't think Halfdan's ever been put in a position where he has to maturely handle feelings for the opposite sex. It's always like, it's just urge gratification with him, or it always has been like, well, I feel, you know, my blood is up, so I'm going to rape somebody. And then that's it.
I mean, what if it's something else? So, I mean, it could be sexual in that way, but what if it's that he has keyed into her power, but he's not quite sure what's tingling his spidey sense about her? You know,
that's a great point. I could be underselling Halfdan's perceptiveness to the situation, and he could be seeing that exactly like you're talking about. It's a really good point. I would actually like that a lot better.
Me
if
too.
That was the case, because I want Halfdan to be more than a one-dimensional character. So
even though he's probably going to murder Lagertha.
Well, yeah, because then it'll just be that much more of like dramatic tension, because you have this character that you've kind of gotten behind a little bit,
yeah,
who's then killing one of your favorite characters, and you're like, oh no.
All right, so we're going to leave Bjorn for this episode, and now we're going to head to Astrid and Harald and Crapagat. And I'm giving credit to Rich Stack, who wrote this on our hashtag no ship, Astrid and Crapagat. So thank you for coining that term for.
Oh my God. Thank you, Richard.
That for this location.
That's yeah. Awesome. Crapagat.
With this scene, Harold's watching the whaling ships come in and as they're about their work, and Astrid approaches him to tell him of her decision. Before she finally gives him the answer he wants, she does talk of her own ambitions and the power of the force of fate. She believes a whale to be a god, and each whale killing a sacrifice. I'm wondering if she's equating her ambitions with the whale, if killing her own ambitions is her own sacrifice. So she agrees to marry him here, and he says, good, I couldn't have waited any longer.
I kind of feel like you're right about that. I feel like there's a metaphor going on about the whale and every part of it being used, because she's getting that information. She's getting him to speak that information out mm-hmm. loud. Like, why are the whales so important? She knows. She's mm-hmm. not stupid. She knows this stuff. She's well-versed in the ways of Viking culture. So she understands what's going on. She wants him to say it out loud. Then she gives the answer after she says, well, I think the whales are like gods, and when we use all of this, we're sacrificing them.
Mm-hmm.
So
let's like think about this theme that has been put before us for this episode about illusions, delusions, whatever. Is this the thing? Is this an example of the lies we tell ourselves to justify our actions?
It's hard to say, because this is Michael Hurst. So as soon as we get invested in one idea, the very next episode, he's gonna flip that over like a turtle in a shell, and we're gonna be kicking around. But I am willing to buy into that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm willing to buy into that, because when we get into the later scene with Lagertha and the Seer, it even gets deeper, you know, and it plays out more. And you have the in the upcoming scene, well, the upcoming part of this scene where the priestess is marrying them
mm-hmm.
and everything, and she's talking about the invisible binding and stuff like that, which is probably in your recap. And
go for it.
And but that is exactly what you're talking about. You know, these things that are going on in our own minds that are invisible to other people, that are tying us to situations
mm-hmm.
that we need to, you know, if we're ever going to make forward progress. I think where you're going with it, or at least I know where I'm going with it, is that if you're going to make forward progress in your life, you have to sort of be aware of these things and then be willing to leave them behind.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you have to be willing to leave them behind.
Right.
Definitely.
Because
otherwise they become weights that sink you.
Yeah. So it's kind of like the snake that sheds its skin. Mm-hmm. It's a necessary thing. Like, you know, the snake would never turn around and want to keep the skin, obviously. So when it comes to these delusions that we have about things, we want to keep them because they've given us comfort and what we believe to be guidance in the past. And now, once we've proven them to be false or detrimental to us, it takes an act of will to say, I have to put this down and get past it, or I will never change and be better and get to my true destiny or my actualization in, you know, more new age terms, I guess.
I mean, it could also be that she's been disillusioned about Lagertha too. So,
yeah.
So maybe it's more disillusionment than delusional.
And we're really on the hook with this, you know, we're just because we don't know what's going on in her mind. I mean, we have the flashback of her and Lagertha in an intimate moment, you know, while they're up there at the altar and the priestess is talking to her and stuff like that. So you don't know if she's thinking about this because she's regretting the betrayal that she's doing, or if it's because she is remembering what's now going to be in the past for her.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's hard to tell. Astrid is an enigma.
So the wedding ceremony is now underway and under a whale rib cage. Harold's fine hair slash fair hair is on full display because that's his name, Harold Finehair, fair hair in history. I was wondering what if Astrid's dress was made partially of whale skin or if it had been treated with
oil,
blubber, because it definitely had some parts of it that looked had this oily sheen to it. Now for the ceremony, the priestess asks Astrid if she is sure about the marriage. The fetters of marriage, though invisible, will bind her. This seemed a warning. The scene ends with Harold saying, "Perhaps my luck has finally changed." Astrid only smiles in return. I think she is thinking, "Doubt it."
You're in for a surprise, bud. I guess we'll see. And it's funny, last episode I had mentioned that what's going on with Floki in Iceland was kind of a stand-in for the things that we don't get anymore, like the scenes in Kattegat where they're or Uppsala where they're doing all of these cool Viking ceremonies and you have Wardruna playing in the background. Then the next fucking episode, here you have one of those scenes I was talking about with Wardruna's music playing in the episode. So there you go. And I liked it.
We have some hashtag no ships about this. Von Brown says, "Cool that King Harold and Astrid got Blue Man Group to play at their wedding. Hashtag no ship, hashtag Viking."
I just blew myself. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Michael. That came out wrong.
Christian Callahan says, "Why does Harold's priest look like an X-Men? Hashtag no ship."
I can't think of the blue. I mean, I just did a reference to it, but I can't think of Blue Man without thinking of Arrested Development. And I did think Blue Man Group, though, too, when I saw that guy in the background, because you can't help it.
Which we've seen, I believe it was in the episode Sacrifice of the first season. I think that was episode 8. I think there was men with that sort of makeup. If not blue, it was maybe gray or...
I seem to remember that, yeah.
Yeah, and they were really intimidating looking priests, especially once everybody started doing the drugs, the mushrooms. Okay, so, all right, now we're leaving Astrid and Harold, and we're going to discuss the Vikings in York. Vitserk reports to Ivar that the hunting party did not return today. Ivar seems unconcerned at their dwindling food supplies. Vitserk wants to know, what is the plan? Ivar is affronted and sees this line of questioning as proof of Vitserk's regret of not leaving with Ube. Vitserk says no, Ube treated him like a dog, and that he is no one's dog. Ivar disagrees with a woof woof. Vitserk leaves the room, followed by laughter. I just want to say, I really liked how the first shot of Vitserk and Ivar was set up with Vitserk sitting alone at a round table, and Ivar sits in a more evidently authoritative fashion at a table opposite Vitserk. The round table is recognizable to most of us as King Arthur's fame table, which was meant to be an equalizer, no apparent head leader. So this has been destroyed among the brothers, if there was ever even a chance.
That's a fucking great catch right there. I really like that. Yeah, because now, like, I'm thinking of it in my mind, that scene, he's sitting above him for the obvious reason, and then the round, like, I got that dynamic right off, but I did not get the round table thing, because if everybody sat there, they would all have, like you said, an equal say in what was going on, and they could have this fellowship of leadership and come up with better decisions, but instead, yeah, good one.
So, what do you think about Ivar's response to Vitserk? Do you think Vitserk was really regretting, or do you think Ivar was putting that on him?
I think Vitserk is regretting it a little bit, and maybe Ivar's reading that. But at the same time, Ivar has to give him a little bit of credit for staying. You know, that has to mean something, because he could have gone with Ube and just... Either way, you know, Vitserk, I think after watching this episode, unless there's a really big change in his character and he gets some forward momentum, he's not long for this world and we won't be seeing him in season 6 or maybe not even season 5.2, you know, or 5.1, well, however you do that, the second part of season 5. And so, but to answer your question, I think it's he's always playing second fiddle to one brother or the other.
Right.
And he chose this brother instead of going back to Kattegat with Ube. So that should count for something. And I think that Ivar's, it's a half and half proposition. Part of it, he's putting it on him. And part of it, he's like, well, if you question my rule, I'm just going to think, or you question my decisions as leader, I'm going to think that you wanted to go with your brother, our brother.
Yeah, because Ivar is still afflicted with past grievances, I think. And those are the, sort of the fetters that bind him and causes some issues with his rule.
I agree with that. He's on the right trajectory to get out of that situation, but he's held back by a certain amount of pettiness that's always gone with that. And I mean, the sting of being a cripple and being seen that way all of that time isn't going to go away overnight or even over the course of a couple of months. But to be a good leader, you don't just have to come up with the cunning ideas for warfare. You have to have long-term plans. You have to be able to handle people. and he really lacks in that department. He can get his lackeys laughing at a joke at the expense of his brother, woof woof, but what are you doing to really forward the progress of your people or your plans by alienating somebody who should be your closest ally and watching your back?
Mm-hmm. And he doesn't even seem regretful. Like, it doesn't seem like he feels like a little bit of pain that he did that to his brother when Fitzurk leaves.
Oh, yeah. No, he doesn't at all. I mean, he's a bona fide sociopath, so it's okay. But, you know, we understand this about him. But he, you know, just, I didn't expect him to have that kind of human consideration. I just expected him as this up and coming leader to try to explore all of the potentials and burdens of leadership and try to fulfill everything that he can, and he's not.
I'm not really holding out for that, because it just seems like we're always going to have this. He's never really going to be able to reach his full potential as a tactician or a leader because of
his nature,
which, I mean, I guess you could describe it as that sort of self-loathing and animosity he has towards others.
Yeah, he won't get over it. He won't come to terms with that and get over it. So
anyway.
He has come to terms with who he is and his place in the world, as evidenced by what happened to him in the last episode with the slave girl.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's positive movement. But in regards to how he treats his brother, in regards to how he is as a leader in the day-to-day stuff, when it's not out there in the battlefield or making the tactical plans, he's very lacking. And it's going to come back to bite him at some point. It has to.
Later, Fitzurk sits on the walls above York. He seeks Odin, wondering if he made the right decision, and asks about his fate. As if in answer, arrows fly at him, forcing him to duck down. Dude, go ask the wizard for a brain before you get killed. Quit talking to Odin.
You know what I thought when I saw this scene? I was like, are you there, Odin? It's me, Fitzurk. It's like a young adult novel about Fitzurk and, you know, what is my place in the world? What am I going to do? And this is really the scene that made me think that he's not going to make it out alive of this season. Maybe not even the first part of this season, because he was only like we called him before, plus one. You know, so he's always just kind of in that weird. I don't see where the story has a place for him, like a solid place for him to be. And maybe it's forthcoming, but if it isn't, I feel like he's going to be arrow fodder or knife or sword fodder at some point.
Well, I felt really sorry for him after that scene, and now I'm rooting for him.
Well, hopefully for your sake, he rallies back and does good, but I'm not holding out much hope.
Yeah, the seer warns us that there's no cure for fate.
Nope. And knowing doesn't help, but we'll get to that when we get to it.
So our last scene is Ivar and Fitzurk walking together as others around pretend to burn bodies. Ivar alludes to a plan based on something he found out about the Romans and what they left behind in York. But he's not sharing this with his brother.
Nope. He's telling him in due time, you'll find out what my plan is, but I'm going to keep it from you because I'm a jerk. So
and you looked this up, didn't you?
Yeah, I was going to bring it up when we talked about the rats, though.
Okay, so we'll wait till we get to the rats.
Right.
Okay. We have a hashtag no ship from Jasmine Nightbloom, and she says, Fitzurk has been banished to the kitty table. Aw, that defeated look on his face now that his food is rationed. He has yet to express his own thoughts and plans. All he's done is follow, but he wonders why his brothers treat him like a dog. Poor puppy. Hashtag Vikings, hashtag no ship.
Well, you know they have that saying where it's great point you bring up, and they have that saying, lead, follow, or get out of the way, which is a really annoying bumper sticker, by the way.
And Oprah says, you teach people how to treat you, so there's that too.
And if Oprah says it, then...
And I know this because of 30 Rock. It's like Inception levels of...
live every week like it's Shark Week, Liz Lemon. So I'm not really fond of that saying as a bumper sticker slogan, but there's a little bit of truth to it in the sense of, like, kind of find your spot and work from there. If what it's saying, Fitzurk isn't doing any of those three things effectively. You know what I mean? He's not. He's definitely not a leader. He's a bad follower because he kind of goes, "Yeah, I'll do what you're saying, but wait, what are you doing about this?" Or you know, asking stupid questions at stupid points where he should know that people have plans of contingency for this, and he's just kind of like meandering around stuff. And then he's definitely not getting out of the way. So I don't know.
Yeah, he just needs to find his angle within the group. Like, you know, Ivar's a tactician, so he's trying to fulfill his role as that, and he knows what he needs to do to fulfill that role. It's like Fitzrick doesn't have a role yet, and once he figures that out, he can start performing tasks that align with that role, if that makes sense. Like, if you're just kind of like trying to get people to fill in the blank spaces for you all the time, you're just going to be that tag along and
in the way
and not contributing. So, all right. So we are leaving the Vikings that have invaded York, and we are now heading to Kattegat, where Ube has arrived, and he's greeted excitedly by Margrett. Torvi stands waiting and unrequited as the boats empty out.
So this was kind of a false hope for her in the first place, because she was there mm-hmm. with King Harald's original audience, where he said that, you know, Bjorn right. had went off to go get some hummus. So she knows he's not going to be there, but she kind of maybe hopes against hope that he'll be there.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if this is kind of meant to illustrate something that we should be like kind of like subconsciously taking in about Torvi, that yes, she is loyal to Lagertha, but she has some sort of insecurities and she would rather Bjorn was there.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I agree. And as her conversations with Lagertha at certain points in the scene show, well, you know, that's an onion to kind of peel off a little bit. There's layers.
Which that particular moment where you see Torvi waiting unrequited for Bjorn is one of the reasons why I love this episode. It's a very small way of coloring an idea into the show, but it just sets so many thoughts in motion in your mind. And it's such a great way to fill out a character in an economic way.
Yeah, anytime you can be subtle and thought-provoking at the same time, that's a huge win for storytelling.
So now in the hall, Lagertha tells Ube he is more than welcome back to their hearth. Lagertha has to lightly intimidate Margrett out of her chair. Lagertha says they have heard the stories of their successes from abroad. Ube suggests that they must have also heard about the death of Sigurd at the hands of Ivar, and he also reports that he is now at war with Ivar. Lagertha offers a mutually beneficial alliance. Margrett looks on, disapproving.
So I really, you know, we talk about how Ube and the other brothers, and Bjorn included, channel their own inner Ragnar at certain times. I felt like Lagertha was channeling what she knew about Ragnar at this time, because I felt like when she bent in, when she kind of leaned to her left, and she was conspiratorially whispering with Ube about like, okay, this is what we're going to do. You know, we're going to, you're going to help me against King Harald. I'm going to help you against Ivar. Let's toast to this. And they talk about the murdered mother and the whole nine yards. I could have easily just switched the heads of Ekbert and Ragnar. And you've got a scene from a couple of, you got a scene from a couple of seasons ago. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt like it was the same way.
I can see that.
Yeah. Of course, Margrett is just like, you know, she needs some peanut butter to go with that jelly over there, which I understand that. I would feel the same way if I was her, because that's your husband. He kind of, out of all the brothers, he resembles the dad the most. You know, that they could conceivably have a union that's more than just, you know, mutually beneficial. It could be a marriage if they wanted it to. And so I don't know. That I would be a little bit like, what's going on over there?
Yeah. And, you know, whoever should really have that seat of power is up for debate, I'm sure.
Yes.
I think that we both laughed about Margrett sitting in that chair and how Lagertha had to, you know, kind of body Ouster. Language her out of that chair.
So I feel like Margrett just kind of said, I'm going to sit next to my man, you know, because Lagertha wasn't there yet. And then it's like, oh, yeah, yeah, okay, I'll get up and move.
I mean, with her behavior, as it's been displayed to us, it's probably more likely that she just took the chair without thinking, without hesitation. So now later, Torvi brushes Lagertha's hair. This is a really quick scene. They're in Lagertha's bedchamber, and Torvi's cautioning against Lagertha placing all of her trust in Ube. Bjorn should be next in line to the throne of Kattegat. Lagertha says, rather flippantly, who knows what the gods have in store for us?
See, Torvi has to walk a fine line here, because she is loyal to Lagertha, but she's probably, on the whole, more loyal to her husband, I would think, because that's her key to staying in favor, staying in food and shelter and everything else. You know what I mean? So it's a situation where it goes, yeah, I want you to be ruler, but if anybody besides you is going to do it, it needs to be my husband, because that's your son. So I'm not doing it out of self-interest. I'm doing it because that's your son, and he should be ruling here.
I would argue that she's actually more supportive of her son, Guthrum, and that's the reason why Bjorn needs to be the next in line, because it protects the future interests of her son, Guthrum.
Oh, okay, that's a good point. I didn't even consider him in the equation because he wasn't even in the episode, you know? But that would work because he still has royal lineage in him, and he, you know, Bjorn would be his foster father, I guess, or stepdad, for lack of a better term.
Next, we see Ube and Margret in their bedchamber. Ube says he will not be sharing her with Fitzurk any longer. Margret voices her doubt about Lagertha's rule. She plants seeds in his ears. This is like one of the scenes where I was like, oh, that just made last season a little bit better, because I remember being annoyed with the whole drama around Ube and Fitzurk and the love triangle between them and Margret after the marriage of her and Ube.
Yeah.
And so it made it a little bit better because this is really showing how there is a huge division between Ube and Fitzurk now, where that was illustrating that strong bond that they once had, the fact that he would share his woman with her, with him.
That's a good point. That is a really good point. It does give a little bit of weight to that, which seemed like a kind of like a dalliance off of the main storyline, honestly, during last season. But I got the impression that Ube did not want to have this conversation. He was like, look, I came back here because I really just want to fulfill my dad's dream that we all get some more farmland and grow as a people. And everywhere I go, I'm either forced to deal with Ivar, or then I come back here and I'm forced to deal with Lagertha's plans. And then my wife wants me to, you know, double cross her. You know, so it's like, Jesus, sailed across the sea. Let me get some sleep.
Well, he did tell Ivar he was going back to take back Kattegat.
Yeah, but...
And the ending shot is a close-up of him where it seems like the wheels are turning in his mind. So I do think he's actually going to start working in that direction where he's going to try to overthrow Lagertha.
So the question then becomes, I was thinking about this earlier today. I was going, okay, if Kattegat is his goal, wouldn't it be easier to, you know, work off of the old premise of keep your friends close and your enemies closer? So he would need to have Lagertha believing that he does want an alliance between the two of them for completely convenient purposes to protect each other from their enemies. But when you're already there, you're already there. It's going to be a lot harder for King Harald to get a hold of Kattegat than it is for Ube to get a hold of it if he's already there and he already has Lagertha on his good side, possibly in his bed, or he's in her bed, or which is a dangerous place to be, guys. It's a dangerous place to be in Lagertha's bed. I'm just going to throw that out there. But
we'll see. Because I'm not sure if they're going to actually hook up in that way. Because I thought they were based on previews, but it was based – the closeness of them in that scene where they were making the alliance, it looked like there was something else going on there. But now that I saw that scene, I'm less
sure. You're skeptical.
Yeah, that's going to go that way. But, you know, one thing I was just thinking now, because I was thinking about, like, season one, anytime there was, like, any challenge to leadership, there was usually – like, with Earl Haraldson, wasn't that his name? And
yeah.
And then Ragnar, they actually had an actual fight. And there was a lot more warring going on. And now it seems like it's a lot more like covert political intrigue happening. And is this because of the influence of the Saxons, since they have kind of had these encounters? Has that changed it? Or was it just something that wasn't depicted to us? Huh. Or am I just going...
I don't know.
Am I not giving them enough credit from early season?
No, I mean, the early season had its own intrigue. Because, you know, there was Harald.
Siggy.
Siggy. Siggy Stardust had a big part to play there. Well, like, you think about when Earl Haraldson sent his half-brother with them. I believe it was his half-brother, and I can't remember his name right now. But he sent them on to go with him on that second raid to Lindis Farm and stuff like that. No, it was the first raid. And they did away with them. And I don't know.
Tried to rape Lagertha.
Yeah. Yeah, so... stuff like that, and then killing him, and then keeping it a secret, and all of this like backdoor kind of stuff. I think it's always been there. It just keeps upping the ante every season on it. But I would agree with what you're saying about their run-ins with the Saxons, because being around King Ecgbert is enough to, you know, have its influence on backstabbing and, you know, like different ways that you can do stuff through diplomacy and then playing one person off of the other. And so I think there was some lessons that were at least gleaned in a superficial manner from their encounters with him. Plus, it would probably be not as compelling TV to watch if everything was settled with a sword fight.
The next scene featuring Kattegat involves Margret trying to convince Torvi that the gods are no longer with Lagertha. Lagertha overhears, much to Margret's chagrin. Lagertha gives Margret the freedom to conspire against her, but she says if Margret can find the courage to be loyal, then she would respect her like no other. Margret flees tearfully. That's some freedom for sure. That Lagertha is granting. What do you think of her argument regarding loyalty taking courage?
Well, before we get to the loyalty taking courage part, I want to address the fact that Lagertha was talking about how every man in her life has betrayed her.
Mm-hmm.
And then she says now all the women are starting to too. And Torvi is behind her.
Right.
And says, I'm not doing that. And she turns around. She goes, okay, yeah, I'm not saying you are, but given the chance, and leaves that dangling, then turns back to Margret. And goes on with that conversation. I don't like where she's going with that, because I feel like she's passing off, when we're talking about loyalty, she's passing off Torvi's loyalty as a thing like, yeah, yeah, okay, sure, you're loyal to me mm-hmm. now, but if you have a chance, we'll see what happens. And she's focusing on Margret's loyalty because she wants to keep Ube close to be a defense against Harald. So I feel like it's less honest. I feel like there's a little bit of disingenuousness going on Lagertha's part.
It's a political game.
Yes. And she's playing off of this young woman's emotions, and it looks like it's working to some extent because she leaves crying.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some effect that was had on her. But this is a time where Lagertha needs to identify her actual allies and be cool to them.
Right. And yeah, and Torvi's, like you said, in the background, and it's kind of like, well, you know, if you're going to accuse me of this thing, I might as well just go ahead and do it.
Right, right. You know, and the shooting and blocking of that scene is very important because she's behind her where the knife would go in. And she's sitting there going, I'm not going to do that to you. I'm loyal to you. You know, but
Yeah, so, you just overheard how loyal I am to you.
Right. And it just, when you have that kind of loyalty, you don't treat it lightly, or you shouldn't. And I feel like the character that we know and love as Lagertha has kind of turned a corner, not just with her actions of, you know, raping somebody, but also in the sense that she's lost her way a little bit her moral compass is kind of broken mm-hmm. right now.
I do love how this scene discusses equality because, you know, when Lagertha walks in, she's saying, yes, we are all equal, because this scene actually followed the scene where we saw Fitzurk sitting at that round table all by himself. But more importantly, Lagertha's betrayal baggage is brought out onto the table once again. And you've already talked about Torvi, how she's listening behind her. And I do wonder if her cynicism will be a component of her undoing. She'll most likely lose Torvi because of this. And I think this is also a parallel to Ivar as well, with his immediate thoughts towards Fitzurk's loyalties rather than addressing the question Fitzurk had put forth.
Right, right. We're getting to this ends justify the means mentality with almost everybody in a leadership position.
Mm-hmm. Almost everybody.
Almost everybody. There are exceptions, but it feels like that's where we're going, at least with Ivar for sure, and Lagertha in her. I'm scared for her character because there's the changes that are going on are not positive.
The next time we see her, she's visiting the seer. She wants to know if she will ever see Bjorn again. Yes, but it will be under terrible circumstances. The consequences of Ragnar's death are not yet played out. We've only seen the beginning of the end. She wants to know what is to come, and he gets really irritable and wants to know if she wants to bind and fetter herself with delusions, and she claims that she only wants to know about her son. He says, too much knowledge is agony. Prepare yourself.
This reminded me a lot part of the theme in God Emperor of Dune by Frank Herbert, when he, you know, the God Emperor has prescience, he can see into the future. He knows what's going to happen, however, like till the end of it all. And he says that is the worst, it's the worst burden you could possibly imagine. He says that path leads ever downward into stagnation. And the seer is trying to kind of do that like small game style with this and tell her like, look, you don't want to know your future.
Ignorance is bliss, girl.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, people talk like, yeah, it would be great to know what the stock market's going to do in 10 years so you can invest in a company or something like that. If you had specific little limited pieces of information, you could do really good. But to know the future is just like he says, to just bind yourself to like bad, bad stuff. But she doesn't want to listen. And I think the whole thing about her only wanting to do this out of regard for Bjorn is, not to keep using a word over and over, but it's disingenuous. I feel like it was a little bit fake. on her part. I feel like she's doing it because she wants to know what her fate is.
Yeah.
And she's pleading a mother's weakness. And like he's going to be more inclined to tell her because it's not for her. But he's the seer and he sees right through it.
Maybe that's one of her delusions. Because, you know, she doesn't seem too concerned that Bjorn hasn't come home where Torvi has.
Right.
That's when she had her flippant response. Who knows what the gods have in store for us? Tosses her hair over her shoulder.
Yeah. There is a lot of blonde hair in this episode.
Yeah, I know. And there is a lot of criticisms about, and I agree with the criticisms because it isn't realistic. But Torvi's hair looks awesome.
Oh, yeah. All their hair looks great. I mean,
especially Torvi's.
Yeah, especially Torvi's, how long it is.
And thick. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really great looking hair. But yeah, they'd be a little bit more dirty.
And Astrid's hair looks pretty cool, too, at the wedding. But anyway, all right, so that's where we had to get. And now we're heading to the scenes with the Saxon. Aethelwulf, Alfred, and Hammond and their soldiers observe York from afar. Apparently, Hammond made a unilateral decision last episode to release Ube and Fitzurk. This is because he is unwilling or incapable of trusting the word of any Viking because they are heathens. Hammond has been turned up to 11 this episode. Why? Does it seem that way, or did the Battle of York do something to him, I wonder?
I think his successes are doing something to him in the sense of not successes in battle per se, because they lost the Battle of York.
Yeah.
But his successes with
Ube
getting Aethelwulf to do what he wants him to do, because he's been a constant voice in his ear, and even up to and including starving them out and everything, he's listening to what he, now Aethelwulf is getting to his limit, as we see, but Haman has had his ear this whole time and he keeps taking those suggestions. So I think he's emboldened by that.
Aethelwulf suggests that they should retreat back to Wessex and build back up their army. Hammond disagrees. He wants to starve out the great heathen army because of a vision he had. Aethelwulf worries that the Vikings may become aware of the plan and attack while the Saxon forces are still depleted. He goes along despite this and tasks Alfred with setting up the blockades. One point I want to address here that I thought was interesting is that Haman's vision ends with the death of the pagans because they were walled up and starved. I think it is interesting because this vision could be a stand-in for his repressed sexual desire. Maybe he is misinterpreting it and subsequently failing to see the warning. But of course, a heathen like me would think this.
Oh, I know. It's possible. It's definitely possible. I mean, I didn't look at it that way. I didn't catch it from that angle. I like it, though.
He could be misinterpreting his vision. It could be all about him.
Yeah, because
it's just saying.
Because if you get right down to it, and we're jumping a little bit ahead of ourselves, they don't go out like that. So his vision is technically incorrect.
Yes.
So, I mean.
And did he really have it?
That's what I'm wondering that, too, because it's like, what did I have in my notes? The vanity of the righteous is almost the worst kind of vanity, because you're hiding behind this ostensible sheen of humility where you say, I'm only here to serve. I'm only here to do the Lord's work. I'm only here to do this and that. But you are basking in the glory of your position, your accomplishments. Everything that would make another man proud, you are grasping onto those same things, but you do it under the mantle of, or the guise, I guess, of humility. And it makes it way worse for me because I just feel like it smacks of a lie.
Wasn't that in the Screwtape Letters, that woman with her tea, her like humbleness of drinking tea? It's been so long since there was something along those lines. Anyways, yeah. So later we see a quick scene of Viking hunters and their conquest vanquished by a Saxon force led by Alfred. That was really my only nitpick. I don't think we really needed Alfred to say, now they'll starve. I thought it was unnecessary exposition, but I guess maybe it was necessary for people who might not have got what was happening. I don't know. I just thought it was obvious.
It is obvious, but if you're watching the show and your mind's not quite on the same page with everything that's going on, those couple of, you know, that one little sentence makes it all click.
Yeah.
So maybe it's necessary for some people to, but you know, I don't like it when – I understand what you're saying, because I don't like it when writers and directors underestimate the intelligence of their audience.
Yeah.
It's like, let us get it and we'll get it.
He just seemed like a cartoon villain for a second, which jars with the Alfred that, you know, he's supposed to be. But anyway, Next, we have the Northumbrians arriving to the Saxon camp. Judith greets her cousin Manel and makes introductions. During the introductions, Æthelred is hilariously passed over by Manel as he voices his excitement to be working beside Hammond and Æthelwulf. No, nice to meet you, dear cousin Æthelred, you non-entity you. Hammond speaks, eyes intense, talking about what the Bible tells them regarding vanity and showing no mercy. His statement that they are the wrath of God reveals his vanity and that he has hit the crank past 11 to 11 billion.
It's not even a real number.
The next time we see the Saxons, they observe York from afar. Æthelwulf would like to fall upon them now. Hammond advises that they wait further still. Æthelwulf brings Hammond to heel in front of God and everybody. Hammond apologizes, saying he is Æthelwulf's humble servant. Æthelwulf does not think that Hammond is humble, but that they will proceed together for the sake of England.
Ballsy move on Æthelwulf's part here. I like that he did it, but I'm afraid for his character because Hammond has ambition inside him that has no place with humility. He wants to get to certain things. I mean, I don't know, you know, the crown is very much, unless you lead a bloody revolution, the crown is very much about bloodlines and things like that. So I don't see how he would go about it that route. For now, he has to kind of, you know, be the kneeler and the bootlicker and go, okay, I'm sorry. Let's just go on about our business and make everything all right. But you can see it. When that shot of Hammond just kind of looking down after Æthelwulf walks away and says, I don't think you're a humble person, but let's just do this for our country, the red, white, and the blue, you know, and so.
Let's do it for our country, the red, white, and the blue.
And that look on his face, that consternation, it lets me know that the wheels are turning and he is not happy with that at all. Because he got dressed down in front of the whole army. You know, people are going to be in their cups later on laughing about that.
I mean, this is a parallel also, which I like, because you had Fitzurk earlier saying, I am nobody's dog, and Hammond got healed like a dog right
Ooh,
here.
Hammond is somebody's dog. Woof, woof. I say Æthelred should have said that. He should be like, woof, woof, and then, you know, have like one of the soldiers be like, you really shouldn't have any lines.
So you think there's going to be consequences, it sounds like, to this?
Maybe further on down the road. Yeah, it's a planted seed of more drama to come. And, you know, the show's all about that. Any good show is. So it was good that it happened. And it was nice to see Æthelwulf just kind of, you know, take on his mantle in full stride and be like, listen, you know what I mean? I am your king, you know, so.
And it's humiliating for Hammond. I mean, it's in front of all of their men and Alfred, Æthelred, Judith, and I think Manel was there too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody saw it.
So our last scene with the Saxons is a scout reports to Æthelwulf that the Norsemen are gone. The Saxons go and investigate. York appears deserted, but why are the rats above ground?
Okay, so my first thought was they didn't really leave. They're not going anywhere. They took those boats and they are like circling back right now or something, you know? And I was thinking to myself, okay, there's been a lot of talk about not just on Bjorn's side of it with going to Rome and stuff like that, but the Roman walls, which was what the point of egress of the Saxon army to come to the first Battle of York. So I say first, cause they're probably going to fight again. So I was thinking, where did they go and why are the rats above ground? Two ideas. The first one I had is that they're hiding underground and they're going to come up and surround them and kind of hem them in and kill them like that. The second one, the first one doesn't explain why the rats would be up there. So I looked up and it says in 1972, an intact section of Roman sewer network was discovered under the Roman legionary fortress in York. It might have drained the bathhouse found below St. Sampson Square. And it goes on to talk about who was emperor at the time and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's going back to like 211 through 17 AD. So it's old, old stuff. So I'm thinking what they did is that oil or pitch or whatever it was that they threw on the Saxon soldiers and lit them up, they've put that underneath the city of York and they're going to light it on fire. That's why the rats are up there.
They're going to do a sept like they did in...
Yeah, in Game of Thrones. I don't think it... Like a sept of Baelor. I don't think it'll be that bangy. You know, but you have this look that goes, he says, when Haman says, why are the rats above ground? And then the way the camera pans over so you get a focus on Aethelwulf's face, and he looks, and then it dawns on him, and then that's the end of the episode.
Uh-huh.
So I think the episode is going to open, at least when it gets to their scene, with an explosion. Okay. That's my call.
Well, they're going to survive, obviously.
Yes, they're going to survive.
Maybe Haman. Maybe not Aethelwulf.
Ah, yeah, good point. I mean, I didn't think that Aethelwulf would have made it this far when we got introduced to him. So there's one of those two is going to survive because no one's going to believe it.
Definitely Haman.
Yeah, no one's going to believe it if Alfred and Aethelred and Judith are going to be running things. It's just not, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then her cousin, whoever, you know, so.
It's either, yeah, it could be Vikings underground. I mean, I think, you know, that would disrupt a rat habitat as well as having a bunch of humans down below.
True. Yeah. So it's either there's going to be an explosion or the Vikings are going to come up from the sewers, so to speak, and get them. And this is what I believe. This is what Ivar found out about the very clever Romans, and he did something very clever himself.
So we have a hashtag no ship, and this is Christian Callahan, and he says, Dreamwolf, worry less about your command position and more about your wife, or Bishop Loose Drapes will give you a third son to raise. Hashtag no ship.
Damn.
So that may be the consequence.
He says, Haman, that's what Haman was thinking about when he was kneeling down in the field. He's like, yep, I'm banging Judith next. It's done.
All right, we are going to end this recap by discussing Floki. Floki continues his conversation with the Allfather as we are treated to beautiful shots of Iceland. Its beauty looms large, especially when juxtaposed with a diminished Floki, probably the only truly humble and prostrate religious man we have yet to see this season. Next time we see Floki, he prepares to leave Iceland to bring back his true believers.
I like the idea. I like it. He's going to get all the people. He's not going to bring the, you know, the riffraff and the people like Ivar's not invited, you know, so he's going to bring back the people who are devout to his pantheon of gods, who would appreciate being in a place like that and knowing how close they are or thinking that they're that close to Asgard.
It will be interesting to see who he brings because, you know, anybody that he would have brought are all dead and gone.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to have to go. I would like to actually see him land somewhere other than Kattegat to try to do his recruiting. That would be optimal.
Torsten would have been one.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you think he would bring DJ Torstein?
Yeah, DJ Torstein, Helga for sure.
Yes.
Ragnar for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely not Rollo, because no. Rollo got baptized.
Yeah, Rollo would not. Oh, no, no, no. No, no Christian magic on this island.
All right, so that's it for the recap. We are now going to go ahead and get into feedback. And as a reminder for next week, we will be recording our recap discussion a day early. So please have your feedback in on Thursday by 7:00 Eastern Standard Time. And that would be Thursday the 21st.
All right, now we are on feedback. Up first, we got PB&J. He says, hey guys, the following are my thoughts on this week's episode of the best show on television, Viking, Lagertha and Uba. Lagertha seems pretty desperate when she presented Uba with an alliance. I think Lagertha is in trouble. Even the seer seemed pretty tired of her act. I don't blame Uba's wife for sensing weakness in her and trying to conspire with Uba to take Kattegat. For his part, Uba seemed pretty ambivalent about taking power. Poor guy can't escape other people's ambitions for him.
Hmm.
See, I agree. That's why I was saying, like, he was sitting there looking up at the ceiling while she's twirling his chest hairs, kind of going, I really don't want to be having this conversation.
Yeah, and I agree that she does seem desperate. In fact, I thought, like, when she was welcoming Ube to the hearth, her voice had all this bravado that I thought belied insecurity.
PB&J goes on to say, Bjorn, Sinric the Traveler is worth his weight in gold. He is better than Ciri. Sinric, what is Byzantine? Just ask him a question and he has an answer. Time will tell if he's the real thing or just a flim-flam man. I'm intrigued by this magical mystery tour of the Mediterranean. Bjorn is a man on a mission. Mm-hmm. Ivar. Sure, he is a jerk, but you have to admit he's making himself indispensable with his strategies. He keeps his plans to himself to build up his own fame and prestige. Hmm. As his successes mount, his value and esteem in his men's eyes increases. He is making himself the sole arbiter of victory. Like it or not, Vitserk is a dog compared to Ivar, and everybody knows it, including Pitzurk himself.
Yes.
So that's a good way to look at Ivar. It's a positive way to look at him keeping his cards close to the chest with all of this military tactical stuff. He's trying to, like, he's going to take all of the credit, fame, and glory for every good thing that the Viking army does in the Saxon lands.
Right? He's into marketing, too.
Yeah. He knows how to sell the Ivar brand. Floki, it's funny how he finally got what he wanted, to commune with the gods, only to have the old zealot rise up again. It's not good enough only for him to live with the gods. He has to build a holy city. He is the master builder, after all. Looking forward to your insights on the show, PB&J.
Cool. I like what you said about Floki. The master builder, building a holy city.
But, you know, when he talks to the gods, he's like, if you want to ignore me, it's okay, because I'm a boat builder. I'm not anybody.
So do you think that was false humility? I mean, with all the false humility we saw all episode, because I was giving him props for being the only humble person as far as, you know, in the religious vein on this show.
No, I actually think it was true humility. I honestly believe that he was, that's why he's seeing what he's seeing. That's why he was there. That's why the gods favored him, because he actually has that humility and left his actual fate to them. And so he ended up in this really special place. And now he's going to fulfill probably what their desires were in the first place, is to have, you know, people who honestly believe in them brought there.
Thank you, PB&J.
Yes, thank you.
All right, up next we have Donuts, and she says, Feliz Navidad, no shippers. I actually really like this episode, which in my opinion was probably as good as it can get without Ragnar. Some thoughts. Ube was smart to pay Björn the highest respects off the bat, so he does have some political sense. Maybe home is the best place for him. Lagertha leaning onto Ube at the table and looking away while holding out the goblet. Classic irresistible Ragnar move. So she's agreeing with you there.
Yeah, see, you can sense it. It just comes off of them like a smell.
Margaret's saltiness for getting booted from her seat and then running away crying after Lagertha confronted her had me in stitches. Did Hurst just hint that Torvi will turn against Lagertha? No!
I hope not. I mean, we discussed it in depth, so yeah. You know how we feel about it, but I hope it's not going to go that way. I hope Lagertha comes to her senses.
Astrid and Harold, I don't want to care, but there was something in their performances at the wedding that had me sitting up straighter. All I want from Björn is a performance like this week. He was normal level, twitchy, tough, amused, confused, like a real person. Is that so hard?
Well, it's like they can write him good, and they can write him... it seems like the less we get of Björn, the worse it is. If you get enough of him on screen, he kind of stretches out and opens up, and we get enveloped in the character of Björn, which we all love. But then when you have these little snippets of him, like last episode, when you have him as Donuts, you like to say, mugging, he's the least effective as a character. Mm-hmm. So just give him more screen time, and we're all going to buy into who he is and what he's about.
Yeah, Björn's a big guy. He needs room to breathe.
Yeah, he is massive. That dude is like
huge.
Give
his character more room to breathe. Donut says, Team Wolf time. I felt his frustration when Hammond claimed to have a vision, because it's impossible to contradict someone claiming God showed them something unless you just say, I don't believe in God, which of course he can't do. But when he got fed up, it was marvelous. The transitions within similar themes in this episode were perfection, and this is what I want to see from Vikings in season 5. They add richness to the text and keep it from being just another history show that we can't stay awake for nightfall. That ending, their faces, run, bitches, run! D-donuts.
Yeah, there's some bad stuff in store for them. Whether I'm right or wrong about what it is, something shitty's gonna happen.
Yeah, I actually was on board with Aethel Wolf as well. I spoke to my dad. He wasn't. He felt it was out of character. And I was like, Hammond would have been getting on my nerves.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to have a trusted, you know, lieutenant or aide or whatever you want to call him, you know, warrior bishop. I don't know if that's a real title, but somebody who knows their shit and is giving you good advice and you can kind of lean on them and everything, but you still have to be the ruler. And it sucks that you have to get to the point where you have to yell at somebody to reassert that, you know, but Hammond doesn't strike me as the kind of guy that you can just go, come here for a second and put your arm around him and be like, all right, can we just chill on the loud in front of everybody stuff? Like, just write this down in a notebook next time you have a suggestion and hand it to me. And if it's better than my idea, we'll do it, I promise. But Like, let's at least give people the idea that I'm still the leader here.
And I guess, you know, sometimes when you're doing something like that, you're not only letting the prime person, like Haman, know, but you're also letting the other men know. Like, he's being devalued in his own mind, hopefully, as well as in their minds. It's kind of like this multi-level move, right?
It is. Yeah, I agree. And it's not always beneficial. I mean, we're all patting Aethelwulf on the back, but Haman's an asset. For sure. And so you want him sharply focused in the best direction that you can. You want to point him like a weapon at what's going on. So you also want to make sure that he's not taking over your mantle as ruler and, you know, having every idea that comes to his head be executed without question or thought.
Right.
But you don't want to dull that weapon either by getting him pissed at you or sulky or whatever else could happen out of this.
Vindictive,
yeah. So there's a number of repercussions that we have yet to see that could come from the way that he did that. But I think it was still fun to see Aethelwulf do that.
Thank you, Donut.
Thank you. All right, up next is Sandy and Haelir. Bullet points, because I can be taught.
Thanks for the bullet points, Sandy.
Bishop Haman and Aethelwulf are brothers under the skin. Their faith in God is strong, but they are flawed men underneath it all and can't help it. Also, they both have a need to lead the same army? Yeah, that. Gets confusing. Any bets will win that one? Floki found his purpose. Fitzirk might have found a clue.
Maybe.
All right, Sandy, we hope that Fitzirk found a clue. I didn't take away anything from this episode that he definitely did, but I'm hoping that he will, or else it's what we talked about earlier. I think he's got his ticket out.
He found my newly won sympathy, which is based on very little. I just felt really bad for him.
Yeah, you kind of just gave that out to him petting a dog, maybe, like a cute stray dog. Halfdan has found his crush, while his brother gets married to Joan Jett and a whale skeleton, which is so rock star. Yeah.
Yes, it is appropriate for Joan Jett. Didn't even think of that.
They didn't show her hands in that scene, but if, you know, before the ring went on. But if you look at her right hand, she's throwing the goat horns. Dun, dun. Great intro to Euphemius of Sicily, who is a rather strong-willed character, marrying a nun against all the rules and fighting against the consequences thereof. I'm really interested in that relationship. The more interesting thing to me, aside from what is going on in York underneath, you know, everything, what's going on there. Aside from that, the most interesting thing to me is like what's going on in the Mediterranean. Like, what is the nature of their relationship? Who is this, you know, Arab leader going to be, and what's he going to be like?
Yeah, Ziad Allah. And I'm also like Euphemius himself. I haven't really pinned him down at first, because at first encounter he seemed like Ivar. You know, like he was a little crazy. But then he seems more sober later.
Yeah. I almost felt like I almost got like a little Dick Tremaine vibe off of him, but that kind of went away. But
that's a Twin Peaks reference.
Sandy goes on to say, I am hoping to see Margrette get hers. Not a clue. The whole enchilada. Wait, eel? Is that better?
Wait. She got the whole Uba episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
His whole enchilada. I'm sorry, Sandy. I don't mean to taint your letter here with my vile words.
Moving on, she says, best ending line in any episode ever, why are the rats above ground? Like, there's no good answer to that at all, ever. Like, shoot me one good answer to that question. Why are the rats above ground? Like, because it's rat playtime. Because, you know, like, that doesn't work. There's no good answer for this. Like, best case scenario, some of us might not get bubonic plague. You know, like, okay. Oh, she has an answer to this, though. So let me read it in order. Best ending line in any episode ever. Why are the rats above ground? Answer. To make bishops like you ask inane questions. They're above ground because something even worse than that is below ground. Dun, dun, dun. Anyway, that is my Reader's Digest condensed version of my comments. Are y'all even old enough to remember Reader's Digest? I was going to just bring this up after I read it. Yes.
How young do you think we are?
Yeah, I'm flattered by this. This is like getting carded, Sandy. This is like you're carding us right now. Like, I'm trying to buy alcohol and they're like, sir, can I see your ID? I'm 42, for anybody who cares. So I definitely remember Reader's Digest condensed books because my parents had them around the house, and I was always intrigued by the idea of them, because you would have, if anybody who doesn't know what they are, they're
They're bound books.
Yeah, they're hardcover bound books that have several, maybe not several, but a few novels in each of them.
I remember the one because there was one, like they would have a little tiny illustration usually at the head of a chapter. Mm-hmm. And I remember I read one because it was like a child's shoe that was like in a street because it was about a kidnapped child. And I was immediately attracted to it because of fear.
You can't look away.
Follow fear.
I just remember being intrigued by these things because I was old enough to understand the idea of condensing the book. So I was thinking to myself, what was left out? Who went through that and decided, like, this chapter doesn't matter? You know, this chapter kind of sucks. This scene is boring. So we're just cutting all that out. So they get condensed down to that. So yes, we do remember them. Sandy goes on to say, thanks for all you do. You're great. And I got to go to keep this short. See, bullet points are fun.
Yes. Great job, Sandy.
Thank you so much. Awesome letter.
All right, our last piece of feedback comes from Benny Jessica. And Benny Jessica says, oh no, now I'm bored.
Bored now.
You are now Darth Rosenberg. She says, I can't see the strong women through all the Botox. I hear the dialogue. It is supposed to sound empowering, but it doesn't when it comes from life-sized warrior dolls made for men. The new SAA ninja with Jesus complex, give head with mouth, is so stuck up and such a bore. He reminds me of a cliche mean girl in a high school movie, just like the bitchy Ivar. I just can't like Ivar. The only time I can feel anything for him is when he has to paint a pic of his evil plans to Scooby-Doo. Woof. I don't know if that's supposed to be Saw Ninja or SAA Ninja, so I apologize, Benny Jessica. I tried to Google it. I don't know what it is. Anyway, she goes on to say, how does the little troll who is with Bjorn know everything? He must be getting notifications from HuffPost, Political, and TMZ to his iPhone 24/7. But in Kattegat, the reception must be bad because the seer just gets bits and pieces. Floki babbling in a beautiful backdrop. Yawn. What?
Oh.
Benny Jessica. Joan Jett trying to play both sides. She won't make it to episode 6.
Wow.
You're putting it out on the table here. We'll see. We'll see, Benny Jessica. Best part of this episode, A. Wolf yelling at the smug closeted sex addict. A. Wolf should yell more. I agree.
Yeah, that's the consensus. He should yell more. We should get a little bit. Every other episode, there should be an A. Wolf rant. You know what I don't like about England? Let me tell you. Let me tell all of you.
Benny Jessica ends with, worst part about the whole show, the competition between Bjorn and Ube, who can copy Travis Fimmel's mannerisms the best. For the love of Odin, give up, fools. You look ridiculous. There is only one Ragnar, and I miss him. Thank you, and skull, Jess.
Skull.
Skull, Jessica.
Well, Jessica, hopefully you will like the next episode better, because I know we thoroughly enjoyed this one, and I'm going to just be honest with you and say I'm not sure who you're talking about. Give head with mouth. Who is that?
I think that might be Haman.
Haman? Like, that's a way to say his name. Said it, Haman, like, give head with mouth.
I think. Jesus complex, give head with mouth, the new SAA ninja. I think she's talking about Haman. Let us know.
Yeah. All right. So this letter was headed, there is only one Ragnar and he is dead.
Exclamation point.
Exclamation point.
It's like a cry for help.
Benny, Jessica is not getting over this. This is not going to go away anytime soon. I could see getting letters from her in season 7. So Ragnar's still dead. And what I didn't like about this episode, no, I'm just kidding. All right. Thank you for writing in.
Yes. Thank you, Jessica. Your letters are always hilarious. So despite your feelings about the show, please keep writing in.
All right. So that concludes our feedback. And that means that we are done for the night. Thanks to everybody who listened and thanks to everybody who wrote in. And like Em had mentioned earlier, Thursday, December 21st is actually going to be when we're recording the next episode of The Wild Hunt. So everybody's submissions to be read on the podcast for feedback have to be in by, what time did you say? 7?
7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time.
Yeah, 7 o'clock EST. All right. This has been a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
And I am your host, Em. Good night.
Good night.